Lake. Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The United States has been accused of a huge covert pro-Western digital campaign targeting Middle East or West Asia. It was reported that dozens of social media accounts, which have been closed, as it's been reported at this point, operated for years in an attempt to influence people in the Middle East or West Asia and Asia. A new study believes the U.S. is behind it. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will ask why the U.S. deemed it so important to alter or to influence the opinions and thoughts of people in this region in particular, and what was their goal behind this. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, joins us. And also Editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me ask you a simple question here from you, Arya Barzari. When you come to understanding what this title means of what the U.S. has been accused, can you break it down for us? Because maybe it could be a bit confusing to some. The accusation, a huge covert pro-Western digital campaign targeting Middle East and in part Asia, which includes Russia and China.
Sure. Actually, it's nothing new when you look at it from a historical perspective. I mean, the U.S. has been always involved in covert plans and missions, either by, coups against various countries, committing coups, inciting coups, or via media, such as the Radio Free Europe during the Cold War, or even after that. What is new in this instance is the use or the abuse of social media. And what is even more interesting is that giant social media companies such as Twitter and Facebook decided to speak up and speak against the U.S. and UK government and played the role of whistleblowers. While for years we used to hear scandals that were Twitter and Facebook managers were involved in it, such as Cambridge Analytica and also various scandalous programs that were accusing Twitter and Facebook companies trying to manipulate information.
So why do you think they decided to speak up now? I mean, this thing was in operation for 5 years, and I can almost bet that it's still going on in one form or another, and even prior to 2012, because it cites the time period of 2012. to 5 years from that point on. So why speak now? Why would they target the U.S. in a sense now?
Well, at this point, we cannot say for sure. We can only speculate that they had enough of the government suppression, and they decided to fight back a little bit. And also, they were hugely harmed by the leaks and reports about how they abused people's trust on them and how they used the information that was supposed to be private and sold it to third parties. So I think they are trying to buy some legitimacy for themselves and try to recover some of the damage that was done previously to them and show to the outside world, show to the users that we are not that corrupt and we are reliable and trustworthy social media companies and we are independent, so to speak, from governments of U.S., and UK. But this is only, I think, I suppose, is the tip of iceberg that these two companies decided to reveal. And sure. The rest of it will stay hidden for years.
Well, I mean, Kevin Barrett, when you take a look at what was done, which I'd like for you to really expand on it for us, from what we understand, there were memes, petitions, fake news, AI-altered profile photos, propaganda, hashtags, and all sorts of things that had to be superficially made up, and that's what the U.S. has been accused of. Tell us the expanding role that the U.S. has been accused of in this particular instance, which focused on influencing people in the Middle East or West Asia, and not to mention Russia and China also.
Well, yeah, the U.S. has worked through these social media companies and through the internet, which was created in the U.S. by DARPA. Let's remember that DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, actually came up with the internet, and it was originally designed as a way to avoid any kind of blockage or breakdown in the event of nuclear war. So it was a command and control and communication system, 3 C's, that was meant to survive nuclear war and be used by the American military intelligence community. That's what the internet originally was. And so they founded it, they got the infrastructure and built the infrastructure to their advantage. And they've been in control of it disproportionately, at least ever since. Now, it's a little bit like the MKUltra program and LSD. And you may recall that the CIA developed LSD and along with a long list of other drugs that it was using to try to brainwash people. And then the hippies got hold of it, and pretty soon they were sort of deprogramming people from the CIA mentality. So here, the internet, of course, has become a tool that anybody can use to a certain extent. But the people who built that infrastructure are still in a position to use it more powerfully than others. And so I guess these revelations, which I haven't really had a chance to investigate carefully, would indicate that what's come out is stuff that we kind of already very much suspected, which is that the social media companies are very much part of the U.S. military intelligence community. Google is widely known to be essentially a branch of the CIA. Google Alphabet has been involved in some of the ugliest CIA criminal black ops, including biological weapons in Tbilisi, Georgia, smuggling the chemical weapons into Syria for use in false flags blamed falsely on Bashar al-Assad, and all sorts of things. So Google is the CIA. Facebook is the CIA plus Israel. Mark Zuckerberg is a Zionist who consults with Bibi Netanyahu. And so what these people do is that they use these outfits of the social media to spin reality in the direction that their leadership wants them to. And sure, they've been doing this to the entire planet. They're doing it to the West, and they're doing it to the Middle East and the Islamic world.
Well, they have done it to West Asia or Middle East, as it's called, to the extent where 40% of the focus was the area of the Middle East or West Asia, and in particular, Iran was their focus. So, Mr. Mohammadi, why do you think the U.S. has such a keen interest in trying to influence and shape thoughts and stances towards Iran through social media? Why this intensity behind that?
Well, it's not a secret that the U.S. Governments, since at least Ronald Reagan, were trying to topple the Iranian system, the Iranian, and also they were working against the Iranian revolution. So what they are doing is exactly trying to brainwash people, which they are not and will not be successful in that. But they might be successful in creating small echo chambers where people who are pro-West and anti-government in Iran or China or Russia might become under the illusion that the majority of people think like them. And the social media is very capable of doing that. And it is addictive. You know, when thousands of fake accounts like your tweet or your Instagram post and give you this wrong impression that, you know, being against, working against your country is a good thing and it's a noble thing according to the Western standards, then you, people, which are very small percentage of the population, might be brainwashed into doing more vulgar things. And they are, I think that they are banking on that. They are, I'm sure, more wise than, you know, to think that they are capable of toppling the government or the system in Iran, Russia or China by thousands or even millions of fake accounts. The time that such techniques could work, for example, during the Arab uprising is long past, and people in Middle East, China and Russia are wiser than that, and they don't get you know fooled twice by the same tricksters.
Okay, we're going to get to some of the things that are fake and not when it comes to Iran, and Kevin Barrett, when it comes to Russia, it actually was cited as being one of the most active campaigns in which the Russian-speaking internet users in Central Asia were targeted, and they focused on criticizing Russia over the civilian deaths, according to the way they saw it, and other atrocities when it came to the Ukraine conflict. Isn't that a way for the U.S. and these fake accounts and what have you wanting to convince people who may doubt what is going on in the Ukraine conflict to accuse Russia rather than, in a sense, then overshadowing what Ukraine is actually doing, because Ukraine also is responsible for some of the deaths, and in the bigger picture, to convince those that target that this military operation that Russia is conducting is not a good thing.
The Western mind control machine has actually done pretty well in this war on Russia through Ukraine, which is what it is. This is a Western war of aggression on Russia. But the global consciousness of that is pretty mixed because the Western oligarchs own a disproportionate share of the global media. So they are using all sorts of means, including the creation and maintenance of huge numbers of fake social media accounts, spam bots, and so on, to try to make people think that essentially the whole world sides with them against Russia, which of course isn't true. The world largely has sided with Russia. The vast majority of the world has refused to go along with the sanctions. And this propaganda blaming Russia for atrocities in Ukraine is actually quite shameful, because the way the U.S. has fought its wars has been to make no effort whatsoever to spare civilian populations, but on the contrary, to deliberately target civilian populations. When the U.S. went into the former Yugoslavia, and then when it went into Iraq, and of course its actions elsewhere in Afghanistan and so on, always involve attacking civilian infrastructure, making life miserable for civilians. They killed perhaps 500,000 plus Iraqi children, as Madeleine Albright admitted during the 1990s, due to the destruction of Iraqi infrastructure, leading the children to be drinking polluted water and so on. So the Americans deliberately targeted civilians.
Let me ask you this, Kevin Barrett. Since you're mentioning Iraq, isn't that one of the things that the U.S. has realized its mistake in a sense? And that is why West Asia or the Middle East is its focus, because many here in this region doubt very highly the intentions that the U.S. has overall when it comes to the way that it exercises its foreign policy, given the fact that they have firsthand accounts of what happened in Iraq.
Well, yeah, the U.S. is behind the eight ball in propagandizing West Asia. And so it is, of course, trying to claim that Russia is committing all these terrible human rights violations in Ukraine, when the reality of the situation is that if Russia had chosen to wage its war on Ukraine the way the U.S. waged its war on Iraq, you would have huge numbers of Ukrainian casualties. They would have leveled much of Kiev, which Russia could do any moment that it wants. But Russia is taking this very slow, methodical approach, minimizing its own casualties and minimizing Ukrainian civilian casualties. And in the areas they're fighting, most of the people identify as Russian and speak Russian and are on the side of the Russians. So it's obvious why they're doing that. But that's the truth. And unfortunately, the media, and including social media, as we're seeing, is dominated by these Anglo-Zionist oligarchs who basically lie about everything. You know, Putin may not always tell the truth, but he usually does. Sure. And when he said that the West is the empire of lies, that was the truth.
Well, I was going to ask you now, Mr. Mohammadi, as I alluded to before, some of the fake news that has been propagated by the U.S. as a whole, and of course through probably some of these accounts that for the period of 5 years targeted Iran. And I'd like to ask you about those and see what you think, such as the lie that the U.S. has spread about Iran being a leading sponsor of terrorism. We could counter that in a sense, and I'd like to get your reaction of how the truth on that is that the war on terror was conducted against groups like Al-Qaeda, Daesh, or Al-Shabaab, none of which are backed by Iran. So that's one of the falsities that the U.S. has premised when it comes to spreading the lie of the Iran being a leading state sponsor of terrorism. Do you agree with that? And what other instances of fake news on Iran do you think is being spread online, even to this day perhaps, by the U.S. through online fake accounts?
I totally agree with you. And to add to that, if you look at the region, Iran was the only country for years to support Syria against terrorist groups such as ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. And even in Iraq, Iran was there to defend Erbil even before the Kurdish region's usual allies in the West. So, of course, it is a propaganda, and of course, Iran is a victim of terrorism. The latest one was the coward act by the U.S. of assassinating General Martyr Qasem Soleimani. So if we look at the record of the countries and not at the propaganda, it is clear which state is committing terror and which state is fighting terror. We were fighting ISIS in Iraq, in Syria, and we were fighting terrorism inside our country for years as well, and still are fighting terrorism. But propaganda machine is getting more and more sophisticated, especially with the advent of social media. And if we use the term coined by French philosopher Baudrillard, the hyper-real or hyper-reality that is created inside this virtual medias and virtual space, sometimes it doesn't refer to the outside reality at all, and it does not need to. So those signifiers don't refer to a signified in the real world. Uh-huh. They are signifiers that refer to the other signifiers, to use the philosophical terms. So it's all in their minds and in the minds of people who are manipulated by these manipulating machines, which are social media, and they have very, very sophisticated algorithms that follow your likes and dislikes and the patterns of your behavior, I mean people's behavior, in order to brainwash them. How much they are successful in that, it needs to be analyzed.
Well, this particular study actually said that some of these, overall, Kevin Barrett, they were not that successful. Actually, they were not able to sway the audience to the intended goals that they had. So why do you think that is? Because that, in a sense, and my question to you is, doesn't that show that the audience out there, the viewers out there, are much smarter now, more informed, especially when it comes to the propaganda leveled against countries like Iran, perhaps, and even Russia and China?
I think that's true. Yes, I think that it's, especially the West Asia region has traditionally been a very difficult audience for Western propaganda. There's this term, the Arab street, that, of course, has been used by the Zionist oligarchs that own Western media and the people in the government who are really annoyed that ordinary people in the Arab world and the rest of West Asia don't seem to go along with the Western narrative on all sorts of things.
Okay.
And it drives them crazy. And sure. I guess that's continuing now as the social media manipulation is probably cultural factors. It's probably harder for them to figure out what motivates an individual in West Asia than it is for them to figure out what motivates an individual in, say, the United States. They probably just don't have enough sort of psyops expertise.
Well, thank you for that. I'm sorry to jump in. We're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, and editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett. Thank you both for your input. With that, we come to the end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yikova Tapoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran is guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Fa'alqa 'asahu fa'idha hiya thu'banun mubin.
So Moses threw his staff, and suddenly it was a serpent manifest.
وَنَزَعَ يَدَهُ فَإِذَا هِيَ بَيْضَاءُ لِلنَّاظِرِينَ
And he drew out his hand. Thereupon it was white for the observers.
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the 32nd and 33rd verses of chapter Shu'ara. فَأَلْقَى عَصَاهُ فَإِذَا هِيَ ثُعْبَانٌ مُبِينٌ وَنَزَعَ يَدَهُ فَإِذَا هِيَ بَيُضَاءُ لِلنَّاظِرِينَ He cast down his rod, and behold, it was a clear serpent, and he drew out his hand, and then behold, it was radiant white to the beholders. These kinds of miracles brought forth by Prophet Moses were the right ones to invoke hopeful and unhopeful things in the people, to use both threatening and not threatening methods. There is one point that remains to be discussed, however, and it's the fact that the word ثعبان is also used in other verses of the Holy Quran, but we have also some various words meaning the same in other chapters and verses. For example, in the 31st verse of chapter Qasas, we read, وَأَنْ أَلْقِ عَصَاكَ فَلَمَّا رَآهَا تَهْتَزُّ كَأَنَّهَا جَانٌ وَلَّا مُدْبِرًا وَلَمْ يُعَقِّبْ يَا مُوسَى أَقْبِلْ وَلَا تَخَفْ إِنَّكَ مِنَ الْآمِنِينَ The verse says, Cast down your staff. So when he saw it in motion, as if it were a serpent, he turned back, retreating, and did not return, O Moses. Come forward, and fear not. Surely you are of those who are secure. So the word jan has been used in this verse, meaning small snakes that move really fast and swiftly. We also have another instance. In chapter Taha, the 20th verse, the word hayya has been used. It says, فَأَلْقَاهَا فَإِذَا هِيَ حَيَّةٌ تَسْعَى So he cast it down, and it was a serpent running. This means a kind of snake, and this is possibly derived from the word hayat. Now, the point I've been meaning to mention is that the application of these various words may raise questions, but they seem to be all for stating one of these matters. They might be referring to the various statuses of that snake. First, the staff changed into a thin and small snake, and then it grew gradually and changed into a gray dragon, as we see in some commentaries, that this great serpent devoured what the other sorcerers claimed that they were snakes. The other possibility is that these three various words may refer to the different characteristics of that snake. The word ثعبان is referring to its greatness. The word جان might be referring to its swiftness and fastness. And also the word hayya might be referring to the life and liveliness of that snake.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So what Moses did was bringing miracles for the people, specifically for the companions of Pharaoh and for himself in the first place. Now people know that he is right. But in the next verses, we will see what kind of reactions they had to this incident. Now, the Almighty Allah, however, tends to use the simplest things to tell people that He is here. He shows His power through the simplest things. What is this rod that Moses uses? It's nothing. As the other verses of the Holy Quran say, Moses answers Allah, "This is my staff. I recline on it. I beat the leaves with it to make them fall upon my sheep. And I have other usages for it." But this simple rod, this staff, changing into a great serpent, is the thing that Almighty Allah can show Himself and His power through it. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Good. If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. We who cry we want Islam and the Islamic Republic know that it is because all have come together under the banner, which is Islamic, and it's for Allah, and they all rose, as we all saw, for Allah. This Islamic Republic enjoys such power, which is in the nation and in other countries too. We have reached a station at which our nation exploded all at once instead of revolution. Such an explosion has been matchless. A nation that has lost everything in the former regime, including his human dignity, and had to depend on others for everything. Then suddenly, that violent outburst and the revolution was on, and it was by the blessings of these morning sessions that brought together all the people, all focusing on one issue. This subject should be further elaborated by leaders of Friday Mass, Friday congregational prayers, so that our foes do not consider us as the weeping nation or the nation of tears. We are a nation who was able by these tears or overthrow the 2,500-year-old power.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytanir rajim. We seek refuge from Satan the accursed, and in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we start another episode of the program, The Spring of Truth. Welcome to this program, in which we try to reflect and contemplate and shed some light and paraphrase some of the sayings and valuable words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, who is the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. So Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh says, if culture is made sound, a country can be reformed. Culture is quite a complex phenomenon, and according to, like, for example, Merriam-Webster dictionary, culture is defined as the customary beliefs, you know, the social forms and norms and material traits of a racial, religious, or social group. So how people, in other words, what the people believe and what they value in their everyday life is their culture.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi salli ala
A part of one's culture is how the men and women of a society believe, and, you know, and this thing, what they believe, is their identity. What they believe about themselves is their identity. So socialists call it their gender identity, what roles a woman or man should play in a society and family, what values they hold for a woman or man in a society. The do's and not to do's are, you know, it constructs a part of their gender identity. Now, to build or destroy a nation, one can work on the gender identity of a society, which is part of a person's culture. Of course, this is a very deep topic, which needs many sessions to discuss and talk about, but I just gave you a hint and a key to think about, and I hope that it was beneficial for all of you. Thank you very much for being with us with the program Spring of Truth. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Every night and every day, never forget.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hundreds of people attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip in a move to express their sympathy and unity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They came to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners who kicked off a series of protests last Monday against persistent mistreatment inside regime jails. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with Palestinian detainees. During the Friday sermon, Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against harming Palestinian prisoners.
Our military wings, including the Qassam and Quds brigades, and the military wings of all Palestinian resistance factions, are all united behind the prisoners. We will spare no effort to secure the release of the prisoners. Harming Palestinian prisoners is an attack on all Palestinian resistance factions.
Over the past 4 days, Palestinian detainees held in 24 Israeli prisons have refused to take part in security checks and returned their meals. They also organized sit-ins in prison yards as part of their protest action.
The Israeli prison service reneged on understandings that were previously reached with prisoners' representatives. It imposed punitive measures, including moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, and banning prisoners from meeting their families. In response to this, the Palestinian prisoners have declared the state of general mobilization last Monday.
In recent weeks, the Israeli prison service increased its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners by imposing double isolation on some detainees. Observers say the Palestinian prisoners have become propaganda material for candidates in Israel's elections.
Palestinian prisoners are escalating their actions because they demand better detention conditions. The suffering of Palestinian prisoners increases every time the Israeli regime plans to hold elections. Israeli officials are using the oppression of prisoners as part of their election campaigns.
Currently, there are some 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, and that figure includes women and children. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has detained more than 1 million Palestinians since the Nakba in 1948, under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
If you're a British citizen waiting for a package to be delivered by Royal Mail, expect a delay. More than 100,000 of the company's workers, hailed as heroes for working through the pandemic, have walked out of the job to fight for a wage rise amid a deepening cost of living crisis.
To come into this action, to get your members motivated.
We didn't create this crisis. The oligarchs in every society, the people that are taking dividends and profits, feeding their own fat tummies and making our people wait for a decent pay rise. That's what's causing inflation, but it's also what's causing bitterness between the classes. Now, we've got to make sure that we rebalance that equation.
The bosses at Royal Mail, a 500-year-old multinational, now privatized postal service, claims the Communication Workers Union, which represents these strikers, has rejected a pay rise offer worth up to more than 5% after 3 months of talks. The union's leader says that's simply not true.
The reason why it's a lie is because it doesn't exist. It's a total fabrication and it's being spun to the media, embarrassingly really, to try and make the company look as though they're being reasonable when what they're actually doing is just disgraceful. So the real situation is that the company made £758 million profit. The company gave away over £400 million to major shareholders and then imposed a 2% pay increase to the workforce.
The walkout is being described as the biggest industrial action of the summer so far, which has already seen workers strike across the railways, ports and the courts.
They all come at a time when the UK is grappling with its highest inflation rate and soaring energy prices in decades.
Today's strike action is the opening salvo in a dispute that could reshape a British institution. And the strikers tell us that they're in it for the long haul. Saeed Purizam, London.
Ewon has held an automotive exhibition titled The New Era of Ewon's Automotive Industry. The event provides an opportunity for auto parts manufacturers and automakers to establish better bonds and meet the needs of the industry and the market through joint cooperation.
We have plans to reform the structure of our automotive industry as well as the relations between auto parts manufacturers and automakers. Moreover, under the plan, the overall promised production target will be achieved in 2025.
According to a report released by the International Organization of Motor Vehicle Manufacturers, OICA, Ewon has been ranked the world's 19th biggest automaker in 2021. Based on the OICA data, Iranian automakers produced almost 900,000 vehicles in 2021. That marked a 2% increase compared to 2020.
We have done a lot of work in the automotive industry, but there is still much to do. A car has more than 2,000 parts, and every day 4,000 cars are produced in the country. We do not have any other industries with such managerial, economic, and technological complexities.
The Iranian manufacturers currently produce 6 different types of vehicles, including passenger cars, 4WD trucks, buses, minibuses, and pickup trucks. The sector has directly employed about 500,000 people and many more in related industries. About 75% of local output is passenger cars, while pickups come in the second place with around 15%.
The auto industry is a key driving force in Ewon, the operation and prosperity of which keeps almost 60 other industries moving. The industry is only second to its energy sector, accounting for almost 10% of the gross domestic product. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
Last year, when U.S. military forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan, thousands of foreign and Afghan citizens were also trying to get out of the country. In those days, thousands of people gathered outside the airport in the hope that they can go inside and catch a flight out. But American and NATO forces failed to control the situation, and then came a disaster. This side of the canal is where U.S. soldiers were standing, using the barbed wire not to let people pass. And this canal is where people were trying to pass and get over the ridge. The explosion also killed plus 183 persons.
I saw people, including women and children, who were running. There were people carrying the wounded with wheelbarrow. Many of the dead and wounded people were thrown into the canal. Women were running and screaming, trying to get to the hospital. We were so close, so we went there and did what we could do to help them.
It was around 6 p.m. when a suicide bomber entered a crowd of disturbed people and detonated his vest just outside the international airport of Kabul on August 26th last year. At least 183 people were killed, including 170 Afghan civilians and 13 members of the United States Army. Some say all that blood is on the hands of the Americans.
In my opinion, Americans are solely responsible for that disaster. The chaos around the airport was deliberately created by the Americans as a cover to allow them to escape. On the other hand, they were aware that such incidents are probable. So why didn't they stop the evacuation process? Why didn't they disperse the people?
Also, some citizens blame gunfire by U.S. troops after the explosion for at least some of the deaths.
We can't confirm that. And,
the Pentagon in a conference acknowledged that possibly U.S. was responsible for some deaths, but later on they said that ball bearings in the explosive vest created holes in bodies resembling bullet holes. Although this explanation sounds so fishy, it is still not known if gunfire caused some deaths or not. Just hours before the attack, U.S. diplomats in Kabul warned citizens to stay away from the city's airport. They were aware of what was about to come, but were not willing to take any steps towards preventing it. Abdullah Hamirzad of Kabul.
Thousands of people rallied in the Gaza Strip to celebrate the Islamic Jihad's victory against the Israeli regime and assert the unity among Palestinian resistance groups. Earlier this month, Israeli forces assassinated a top Islamic Jihad military commander in Gaza, prompting retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance movements. Israeli forces killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children, during the 3 days of fighting. The Islamic Jihad maintains that it has achieved an honorable victory in the latest confrontation with the Israeli regime. Addressing the rally through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Ziad al-Nakhala praised the unity among all Palestinian resistance groups during the three-day war.
The thousands of people attending this rally today are proof that all Palestinian resistance factions are united against the Israeli enemy. We assert today during this victory and unity rally that armed resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine and regain our rights.
The popularity of Islamic Jihad movement continues to gain momentum among Palestinians due to its refusal to recognize the Israeli regime and its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation. During the 3 days of intense fighting, the Islamic Jihad rockets shattered Israel's so-called invincibility myth.
Al-Quds Brigade is sending a very strong message today to the Israeli enemy regarding the growing might of the Palestinian resistance. The enemy thought that assassinating Al-Quds Brigade commanders will weaken the Islamic Jihad, but that did not happen. Al-Quds Brigade are stronger today than ever and will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
During the 3 days of fighting, the Islamic Jihad military wing fired hundreds of rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories. Observers say that the Islamic Jihad fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime, forcing Tel Aviv to demand a ceasefire.
The strength of the Palestinian resistance has forced the Israeli enemy to ask for a truce. The Palestinian resistance is here to protect the Palestinian people and to liberate our land. The Al-Quds brigades have managed to fire hundreds of rockets at the enemy and forced it to evacuate their towns and run for cover.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008.
Experts believe that in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The outgoing British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has paid what could be his last visit to Ukraine as Premier. Meeting with President Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, on Wednesday, Boris was hailed for his relentless support for Ukraine's war effort. He was even given a medal for his services. In the midst of ceremonies and handshakes, Johnson, however, reminded his fellow countrymen that there will be more economic hardships to come.
We also know that if we're paying in our energy bills for the evils of Vladimir Putin, the people of Ukraine are paying in their blood. And that's why we know we must stay the course.
Following the NATO-inspired conflict in Ukraine, Britain has pushed a hardline policy of arming the Ukrainians and sanctioning Russia. The result has been catastrophic on the British economy, further exacerbating a cost-of-living crisis and raising fuel prices to eye-watering levels.
Boris Johnson is completely out of touch with reality. This millionaire prime minister is telling the British people that they're going to have to continue to tighten the belts. He's presided over probably the worst cost of living crisis in living memory, which has been precipitated in large measure by Boris Johnson and his government's support for a war in Ukraine, which could have quite easily been avoided. Energy bills have already doubled, or certainly gone up by well over 50%. We're being told by the energy regulator that the cap on energy bills is going to be increased still further. Already we have food banks in every town and city in this country because people can't afford to eat. Now we're going to, it looks like, have to set up in the voluntary sector kind of warm banks, I suppose, where people will be looking to go to community centres to keep warm. This is an absolute outrage.
Despite the hardships, Johnson's comments have made it perfectly clear that costs will continue to rise even after he leaves Downing Street.
and British taxpayers are going to have to pay the price.
Boris may be enjoying the reputation he's built up for himself inside Ukraine, a country now left devastated by the war. However, his popularity at home may take another dive as the winter months rapidly approach and families will inevitably struggle to heat their homes and feed their loved ones this Christmas. Robert Carter, London.
Iran and Tanzania have vowed to draw a roadmap for developing bilateral relations in various dimensions. One of them is economy and trade. In this regard, Tanzania's business hub, Dar es Salaam, hosted a joint meeting of economic and trade activists from the two countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, addressed the forum, saying the development of economic relations with African countries, especially Tanzania, is one of the foreign policy priorities of Iran.
The African continent is one of the major economic diplomacy priorities of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Along this line, Tanzania, as one of the most important countries in the continent, has always had this special status in the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
He also expressed that Iran is prepared to help Tanzania achieve its goals of development and industrialization. He added that both sides are determined to prioritize economic diplomacy. Over 20 Iranian public and private sector companies took part in the forum to show Tehran's serious will for business cooperation with Tanzania.
Africa is a very huge market, and many world powers come to Africa for discovering new opportunities. So I'm here with the Iranian delegates to explore the east of Africa, especially Tanzania, to find out the opportunities, especially in telecommunication business, as our company involved in telecom sector.
Business cooperation between Iran and Tanzania is a bilateral opportunity for the two sides. In addition, Africa is the perfect market for Iranian goods like petrochemicals and the food industry products.
Tanzanian economic activists expressed their excitement about the expanding economic ties, saying they had been eagerly waiting for the joint business forum to kick off.
So there is a huge opportunity. Also, having this forum in Tanzania, we have been looking for it for several times. We have been asking for it because we know for all the challenges that we have been observing, this kind of forum can build up that bridge, can bridge up a gap of closing those challenges. So for us, it's a big marriage.
It is a fruitful opportunity for both countries, Iran and Tanzania, to do cooperation in business, especially in trade, so as we can do exportation and importation of different commodities from two countries. And it is politically stable. We invite more Iranians and other investors to come invest in Tanzania. We have so much opportunity, so guys, you can maximize profit, but also make Iran better and Tanzania better.
Taking Africa's economic potential into account, the Islamic Republic opted to expand relations with African countries. Foreign Minister Amir Abdollahian's tour can be the launchpad for the Iranian government's long-term plans to expand trade with Africa.
Tehran has attached considerable significance to Africa as it looks to expand its ties with countries beyond West Asia. And Amir Abdollahian's African tour highlights the view that the world is not limited to the West. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
Evidence continues to mount that France and the Eurozone are facing a long period of recession. French economic output just contracted for the first time in 18 months, with Germany's business activity plunging even deeper. The decline in output and demand has almost too many causes to list. At 6 months into the unrest in Ukraine, Europe's energy import costs have now quadrupled. The costly conflict shows no sign of easing as Brussels has abandoned diplomatic efforts with Moscow. The current drought across the continent appears to be the worst in the last 500 years, hurting crop yields, sparking wildfires, and increasing pessimism. That's helped push the euro to its lowest level in 20 years. The euro is now worth less than the United States dollar.
There are obviously many crises which are causing major problems for Europe, and many are linked to what's going on in Ukraine. However, we should not